So what was it like going back to the book, getting ready for this?
It reads really quickly. That was yeah, kind of cool. And yeah, I've got enough distance on it now. It's funny. I still remember stuff I agonized over at the time, and I'm like, oh, nope, this works fine now. But it's like, yeah, you when you're in it, it's easy to get hung up on, you know, specific minutia or exactly yeah, how to frame stuff. And then once you've done it and you get away from it a while, it's nice to go back and say, yep, I can see why I fretted over that, but it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Do you ever have the moments at any point where you kind of cringe at certain parts?
Not these days. When I go back to stuff I wrote like 20, 30 years ago, yeah, occasionally, but that's just, you got to recognize you're a different person now, yeah, and different. It's like, I got over this hump in my 40s where for a while reading my early work was really painful. And then I just sort of came out the far side and I was able to see it on its own terms. And I'm like, this is fine. It's yeah, not how I would write it now, but that's okay. I couldn't have gotten to where how I write it now without doing that first. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah, that makes sense. One might bristle at the paradox of a Victorian Renaissance man. It is a time-transgressive concept, after all. But Charles Wheatstone would be hard to explain in any other way. Born in 1802, Charles was raised by a music seller and apprenticed under his uncle and namesake, who made and sold instruments. However, Charles was not one for manual work, and veered more into the life of the mind, translating French poems at the age of 15, and writing a song which contained lyrics that would end up on a Bartolozzi engraving. Yet his most significant contributions would come in the form of the Playfair cipher, an encryption technique, and the Wheatstone bridge, a form of electrical circuit that allowed for accurate readings of electrical resistance. However, it would be his invention of the stereoscope in 1838 that would end up being one of the very first instances of breaking through into the third dimension via technology. The concept is quite simple, though in Wheatstone's construction, bulky, in that Charles worked with the weakness of the singular eye's vision, and created a contraption out of mirrors that refracted identical images to opposing eyes staring through a bifurcated looking glass. As the eyes attempted to reconcile the images into one full field, it caused a visual effect that seemingly brought the subjects of the photos to life in a more three-dimensional format, making it appear as if the images were actually solid and moving ever so slightly. This idea was further simplified and marketed by the likes of David Brewster and Oliver Wendell Holmes, who turned the construction into something more portable. Brewster's construction has a similar build as a pair of binoculars, whereas Holmes made it portable and cheap with a handle and largely wooden construction. Yet it is Wheatstone that delivered the idea first, and it remains a fascinating fact that the development of 3D technology is still wholly dependent on working with the human body, its weaknesses and strengths, to push forward in our ever-expanding transcendence through technology. It should also be recognized that Wheatstone's initial conception of this idea was fairly low on his list of achievements. The idea that it may be the small offerings of creators that perhaps make the biggest waves in the tomes of history should embody a humility in all of our human endeavors. Yet, this is where we began, at the origins of the technology that this podcast seeks to explore. We shall walk further in the shoes of Wheatstone in future episodes as we continue our journey.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
So, first off, do you mind giving the audience a basic description for 88 Names, which will be going on sale as of today, which is March 17th, 2020? Something that will ignite our listeners' appetite to pick up the book and read it.
Sure. So the book is set about 20 years in the future at a time when fully immersive virtual reality technology has finally come into its own and, you know, lived up to the hype we've been getting all of our lives. And the book's protagonist, John Chu, is what's known as a Sherpa, which is a paid freelance guide to online games, more specifically online role-playing games. And the way this works is, you know, say you're someone with more money than time and you want to play the futuristic version of World of Warcraft, but you don't have, you know, hundreds of hours to spend building up your elf paladin to level 200. So you can pay a Sherpa a fee, and they will provide you with a ready-made high-level character with, you know, amazing weapons and armor, and a team of experienced players to come with you, and they'll basically cater an adventure for you in this virtual world. You know, you can go fighting in swords and sorcery, or a space battle, or whatever you want. And Sherpas are not affiliated with the game worlds that they operate in, and a lot of the companies, you know, view their activities as a violation of the terms of service and the end user license agreement. And there are in-game EULA cops who will, you know, try and track down people for this, and if they catch you doing this, they will ban your account. But so Sherpas operate in a sort of black market, but the loss of accounts is just part of the cost of doing business. So they keep multiple accounts. One gets banned, they'll just switch to another. So that's part of what the title is about, that they have 80, you know, John Chu has 88 names. And basically in the story, he gets a new client, a pseudonymous, the guy goes by the pseudonym of Mr. Jones, and he claims to be a wealthy, famous person with powerful enemies. And he's offering $100,000 a week for a comprehensive tour of the world of virtual reality gaming, which is, you know, it's a great gig, but obviously John Chu wonders, gee, what am I getting into here? And as the tour gets underway, he begins to suspect that Mr. Jones may actually be the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, whose, you know, interests are about more about power and propaganda than entertainment. And the first two thirds of the novel take place entirely in virtual reality, and, you know, either in the game worlds or in virtual chat rooms or so on. And everybody you meet has, you have total control over how you look and sound. With instantaneous machine translation, you can pass yourself off as a speaker of a language you've never studied. And most of the people that Chu interacts with, you know, not just Mr. Jones, but his coworkers and even his ex-girlfriend, Darla, are people he's never met in real life. And, you know, people give you their name, you can look them up on social media, you can Google them, but that's not foolproof either. So there's this constant guessing game of who am I really dealing with, and what are they really after? And that's the basic idea behind the novel. And to say more than that would get into spoilers, but yes, that's the basic concept.
Yeah, it's a really fast-paced novel, and it's one of those things. When I read the description before I read it, I chuckled quite a bit, because this is very much Matt Ruff.
It really kind of is.
Yeah, it is. So speaking of, as an author, you have explored some really unique worlds, including a satire of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, the reversal of national roles in 9/11, and the intersections of Lovecraft and 1950s Jim Crow history. With this new book, you are looking into the world of virtual reality, like you've talked about, and a future where these geopolitical actors are potentially beginning to use this technology as a form of manipulation for their own will. Do these ideas just pop into your head, like revelation from the gods, or are all these things that flow naturally from your own interests? And in what way did 88 Names come about?
So there's a psychological phenomenon called apophenia that I sort of mentioned in passing in 88 Names. And this is where you assign meaning to coincidence. And apophany is a false epiphany. So, like, say you're leaving the house in the morning and your kid's watching Dumbo on the Disney Channel, and you happen to notice this. And then you go outside and you look up and you see a cloud that's shaped kind of like an elephant. And you're like, huh. And then as you go about your day, you start noticing other elephants, and you start thinking to yourself, what's going on? What does this mean? And it doesn't mean anything. You're just having an epiphany. And people with schizophrenia are particularly prone to this, but we all experience it to some degree. Yeah. It's the driving engine behind conspiracy theories. And it can also be a creative force, and it definitely is in my case. I learned early on that I have a knack for finding connections between seemingly disparate story ideas and bits of business, and connecting them into a coherent narrative. And this has been the case with a lot of my novels, where it's a bunch of different ideas sort of bang around in my head and eventually come together. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's a story. So for example, my second novel started out just as a title. I was at the bookstore one day screwing around in the fantasy section and looking at all of the trilogies that had been inspired by Lord of the Rings and, you know, all the fantasy trilogies that followed and the success of that. And I asked myself, well, what's the weirdest title for a trilogy I could come up with that might conceivably be a good story? And so I was just, you know, riffing on a bunch of ideas. And the one that stuck was Sewer Gas and Electric, the Public Works trilogy. And I'm like, well, what would a story like that be about? And for a long while, I had no idea, but I sort of filed it away in the back of my head. And eventually it bumped up against this other idea I had that it would be kind of cool to write some kind of satire about Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, that in which Rand herself featured as a character and could like defend her own philosophy. And that bumped into another idea I'd had, or a series of ideas that I'd had after watching the movie Die Hard with Bruce Willis. And if you're listening to this and you're wondering, well, what does Die Hard possibly have to do with Ayn Rand? And what does Ayn Rand have to do with the Public Works trilogy? The answer is nothing, but I had an epiphany, and I used the power of fiction to turn it into an epiphany. And that's kind of how it happens. And, you know, sometimes it's just a bunch of different ideas. Sometimes I have a basic idea of a story I want to tell. I have to let it bake for a while and let other weird ideas sort of glom onto it and flesh it out and make it richer than it would be if I just went with that initial thought. So in the case of 88 Names, it basically grew out of a lifelong love of gaming. When I was 12, I worked for a while as a playtester at a company in Manhattan called Simulations Publications Incorporated. And they were a war games company. They made board games that, you know, simulated famous military battles. And a lot of them had titles like, you know, Austerlitz or NATO Division Commander. But they also did science fiction and fantasy titles, which were the ones that I was most interested in. The first game I ever worked on was called Creature That Ate Sheboygan, and it was a simulation of a fight between Godzilla and the Wisconsin National Guard. And, you know, the way this would work, you'd come in, it was usually Friday nights were playtest night, and you'd come in, you know, after school and hang out until late at night playing prototypes of these games. And the idea would be to see what worked and what didn't, and were there any degenerate strategies that, you know, would allow one player to always win the game. And so, like, my contribution on Creature That Ate Sheboygan was I discovered that if you played the monster at the beginning of the game, you could build them. You got to build, like, pick the abilities that the monster would have. And so you could design a monster that wouldn't fight the National Guard, but that would, like, basically avoid them. So you'd give it fire breathing and then avoidance abilities like jumping. And then you would run around the map setting fire to all the buildings, and you got victory points for property destruction because you're Godzilla. And the tanks would try to chase you and the other National Guard units, but you'd just leap over the lines of burning buildings and get away. And I think in the finished version of the game, this is probably still a viable strategy, but in the prototype, it was just, you wouldn't lose if you did that. So So that kind of stuff was cool. I mean, it's, you got to play games, but you also got to think about the design elements and how the distinction between, you know, the sort of the game designer has this idealized idea of how it should be played. And then the players have their own ideas that often include things that the designer would never think of. And that was kind of cool. Other things that happened while I was there, it was at SBI that I first learned about this new kind of game called a role-playing game. I have a very distinct memory of walking down a hallway with Jim Dunnigan, the head of the company, and asking him, you know, what's this Dungeons and Dragons thing I keep hearing about? And he explained it to me, and my eyes bugged out, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I've got to run out and get that. And I did, and, you know, changed my life. And SBI also was my introduction to computers. The company had an IBM mini computer. This was the late 70s, so a lot of companies still had mainframe computers, which were computers that were the size of entire rooms, right? And the mini computer was a scaled down version that was the size of a large desk. And, you know, the computing power was dwarfed probably by modern smartphones, but, you know, at the time these were cutting edge machines, and the company used it for processing customer survey data. This was how they figured out what games people wanted to see next. but it came preloaded with the Colossal Cave Adventure and a text-based Star Trek simulator as well. And I got to mess around with those and, you know, was instantly hooked. And the company also invested in what were called microcomputers. And those were the first desktop machines, which was like, oh, my God, a computer small enough to fit on a desk. And
that's, you know, awesome.
That was my introduction to programming. So so I got bitten by the bug, and I was only there for about a year, year and a half, when the company ran into financial trouble and they got bought out by TSR, the Dungeons and Dragons people, who I think they fired everybody and closed the office down. So one day I came in to, you know, look for playtesting, and they weren't there anymore, which was kind of sad.
Oh, wow.
But I was already infected, and so because I was an only child and an introvert, and I am perfectly happy to play games by myself, video games in particular really appealed to me. And it's probably good for my productivity as a novelist that really until very recently, I could never afford the most cutting edge computer technology.
Yeah.
I did get computers, but they were always a generation or two behind. And, you know, my wife and I were among the last people in America to have a dial up connection to the internet. And this became, I think, particularly important around the late 90s, early 2000s, when geniuses figured out a way to put Dungeons & Dragons on the internet and created the massive multiplayer online role-playing game. And that's a whole lifestyle. You can, you know.
Oh, man, no kidding.
Yeah, people get addicted and just lose themselves in those. And I would have loved to have done that, but we just didn't have the internet connection to do that with. So what I did instead for a long time, I would read about these games. I read articles in Wired. I found blogs by game designers like Rafe Koster is one of the guys who was behind, or Koster. He was one of the guys who did Ultima Online, which was one of the very first online role-playing games. And it was just sort of fascinating. And it was through this reading that I heard about this phenomenon called gold farming, which was where people would play these games and accumulate virtual goods like gold pieces or magic swords or an armor, and they would sell them to other players for real money. And, you know, you could make a lot of cash doing this, at least in the early days. Like, people were paying $500, you know, $1,000 for truly rare magical items, for example.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What made this even more remarkable was, you know, this was before PayPal. So people would like be mailing cashier's checks to strangers in other states. And it'd be like, yeah, here's $500, you know, meet me in the game world on such and such a date in such and such a place and hand me my sword. And, you know, more often than not, it would work. But from a design perspective, this created real headaches for the game companies. First of all, some of them just objected to the idea of people making fortunes off of their intellectual property. They, you know, because they weren't affiliated with the companies at all. Companies didn't get a cut of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it also created customer service problems where players heard about this and they thought, well, geez, that's cheating that these people are buying advancement in the game rather than winning these items honestly. And if someone got cheated on a deal, they would call up the company and complain, and the company would have to explain, look, we're sorry you didn't get your magic sword, but these people don't work for us. We can't help you. And it also encouraged really antisocial behavior in some cases. Particularly the earliest generation of online role-playing games were often very open-ended in the kinds of behaviors they allowed players to engage in. So you could, for example, basically attack any other player at any time and try to kill them. And if you killed them, you could, you know, resurrection was possible. So it wasn't like they were dying permanently. But
yeah,
Still, if you killed them, you could loot their corpse just as you could if you killed someone in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So if they had a magic sword that they'd paid $500 from, you could take it from them. And, you know, if they had built a house in the game and you found their house keys while they were being resurrected, you could run back and find their house and go in and steal everything out of their house. And this was like a feature, not a bug in the original idea of the games. But the thing is, when these virtual items have a monetary value, you're encouraging that kind of behavior even more than it would exist if that weren't the case. So
yeah.
Later generations of video of role-playing games, a lot of the rules you find when you play them are basically direct responses to these kinds of exploited behaviors. So, you know, in World of Warcraft now, powerful magical items generally can only be, they can't be purchased. They have to be earned by, you know, defeating really high level monsters or by crafting them yourself. And they're bind on pickup. So basically, once you have it, you cannot transfer it to anyone else. You can't sell it. And that's, that rule is only there because they don't want people, you know, they don't want people making money off it without, you know, without permission. And there are limits on player versus player combat, but because they still want to allow that, they, you know, there are ways to fight people who don't want to get into fights with you. So all of this just sort of fascinated me, that this, this design problem. And again, this, this disconnect between the idealized version of the game that the companies have and then the actual goals that players get up to once they're loose in the virtual community. So I basically got it in my head that I wanted to write a story about someone who was like a gold farmer, and then also talk about you know, the way people behave in environments where they are anonymous or pseudonymous, and you know, the worst consequence for bad behavior is maybe you get your account canceled. And I started thinking about this in the early 2000s. And then, you know, as time went on, as this idea was maturing in my head, it's like Twitter happened and Facebook happened. And what was initially this sort of niche online, you know, this niche hobby for weirdos on the, you know, nerds on the internet became much more central to society. And so that became a part of it as well. And that was, so it's why I finally decided to do the book when I did, because it just seemed like, yeah, it, it's not just about video game players anymore. This is, in a sense, we're all kind of caught up in this, this online role-playing game, whether it's just, you know, playing around on Twitter or, you know, yelling at the president or whatever. So that's a somewhat rambly discussion of how I came to this.
No, that makes complete sense. And I can see a lot of the ideas that you're talking about there feeding into the novel, you know, stuff like the pseudonymity, which I have a question about here before too long. And kind of this commodification of technology, because it sounds like even from your early days, it sounds like computers, even back in the 70s, were used for basically figuring out consumer taste. So there was a capitalist lane going on in there.
Well, that was one of the things that SBI did right. It was just unfortunate that I actually, Greg Kostikian, the designer of The Creature That Ate Your Boy, again, he wrote an essay many years ago called A Farewell to Hexes about the why SBI went bankrupt. But one of the things he notes in there, that one of the things that SBI did right was this by using these consumer surveys, they could say, you know, would you be interested in a game about this battle? Would you be an interested game about this? And they would know from the responses that if we make this game, we'll be able to sell X amount of units because there are people who want this. So that was, and computers allowed them to do that much more easily.
Yeah. It takes away a lot of the math of statistics. Yeah, no doubt. So that brings us to the cast of characters here that you, in this book, and you have several. You mentioned John Chu, you mentioned Mr. Jones. You have Ray, Jolene, Anja, and Darla, who are largely acquainted with John Chu and his Sherpa business. And so all these people, with the exclusion of Ray, have a diversity to them. And so I think
present themselves as
exactly.
Darla and Ray both present as white. You don't know what they really are until the last third of the novel, when we move out into real life and the masks come off and you find out who is really who.
That makes complete sense.
Derooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. Derooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at derooted.com.
So how do you as a writer figure out how to cast your book's characters? And what made you decide this time to make your main protagonist and his mother Chinese American, and the rest of the cast, quote unquote, probably multiracial or with the, you know, they're disabled or whatever it may be. So,
so in John Chu's case, I mean, the historically this phenomenon of gold farming is associated with China, because the Chinese sort of basically they figured out a way to industrialize this, where they had, you know, whole slews of people working in what were essentially sweatshops, gathering virtual gold and stuff and selling it. So whereas the American approach is more like it was an individual hobbyist might, you know, decide to make a little extra coin on the side. And in China, it was this big deal where it was actually a job that people had, where you become a gold farmer and sell money to, you know, other Asian players or Americans. So partly it was a nod to that. And then partly also it was that, I guess it's, you know, Asian men in stories, at least traditionally in American movies and TV and novels, are often presented as essentially sexless. And I knew that one of the things I wanted to explore in this novel also is the idea of online relationships and particularly sexual relationships like cyber sex. So as I say, John Chu has this girlfriend, Darla Jean Covington, who he's never actually met face to face, but they've had a sexual relationship online. And there was a part of me that would be kind of interesting to have an Asian character engaging in that role, where it would be normally the kind of thing you'd probably do a white protagonist. Yeah. And I've heard Asian actors talk about this. I never get to play the romantic lead. So this part of me like, well, if we get lucky and make a movie out of this, then maybe the actor will get to do some interesting stuff that you wouldn't normally expect them to be able to do in a story like this. So that was part with that. And then the character of Anya, who she's a former Olympic gymnast who's basically suffered a crippling accident. So she's now almost completely paralyzed. So she can't even breathe on her own. But through this special VR helmet that can read her, you know, her thoughts, she's able to have a life of sorts in virtual reality. She can, you know, live and walk around and talk in the virtual environment. And so there it was just like I wanted to touch on that. You know, the cool side of this technology is it is going to enable, it's already begun to enable people with disabilities to have more options to live fuller lives online. And there's a downside to that too, that if you get a stalker on the internet and you're Anya, you can't leave, because leaving the internet means you go back into your body and just, you know, stare at the ceiling. So then a lot of the rest was just sort of like, yes, like playing with this idea of, we have these stereotypical ideas. People claim to be, you know, people want to be more enlightened, but still a lot of the thought about diversity, people have very stereotypical ideas of people. And I wanted to kind of play with those expectations. And John Chu, partly because he's an entrepreneur, spends a lot of time trying to figure out, okay, who are you really? What do you want? How can I appeal to you? So a lot of the variety comes from that in this story. More generally, my dad was from the Midwest, but my mother was a missionary's daughter who was born in Brazil, grew up in Argentina, and emigrated to the United States in her 20s. And our house was Ellis Island for the South American relatives. So I grew up in a kind of multicultural, multi-religious household. Like most of the family was Lutheran, but there's a whole branch who converted to Mormonism. So theological debate was a big thing in our house. And I'm living in New York City, meanwhile, in, you know, the immediate aftermath of the civil rights movement. So it was a weird childhood. And I've always been interested in stories with people from very different backgrounds being forced to interact with one another. And I also like trying to write psychologically realistic portraits from the point of view of people who are not like me, because it just interests me. I'm happy that, you know, the society is changing now. It's more open to this kind of storytelling, and there's definitely a movement to embrace diversity. Although even now it's sort of like there are interesting and less interesting ways to do it. And I feel in a lot of cases, it's still like, let's just check a bunch of boxes or, you know, like one way of doing quote unquote diversity is not to be diverse at all, but to set a story in a different community than is normally spoken about. Like, With the Mirage, for example, it's set in an alternate universe where basically the United States, it's a 9/11 story in which the United States and Arabia have basically switched places. So it's the United Arab States is the superpower, and North America is just this collection of basically third world countries, and it's Christian fundamentalists flying the planes into towers in downtown Baghdad, and the more democratic Arab states declaring a war on terror. But the thing is, it doesn't just switch the geopolitical situation. Mm-hmm. It also switches the idea of who matters enough to be the protagonist of a story. So in the Mirage, it's not just the good guys, but the bad guys. Almost everybody who matters in the story is an Arab Muslim. So the protagonists are members of Arab Homeland Security from Baghdad, but the real bad guys are, you know, Saddam Hussein, who in this reality is a gangster, and Osama bin Laden, who in this reality is a war hero and a senator, but with a dark hidden agenda. And the Americans are like cannon fodder. They're the nameless villains who show up and try and kill people. And, you know, you've got like maybe the one or two Americans who are there to prove that not all Americans are bad. It's like, oh, you know, we're not all terrorists.
Yeah.
And but that guy only is in the story to say that and to sort of name check that virtue. And then you get back to the people who really matter. And that to me is kind of a more interesting way of doing diversity, where very often when you're trying to present recreate the demographics of America in a story, what ends up happening is if you have like one black character or one Muslim character, that character becomes not so much an individual, but a stand-in, an idealized stand-in for an entire community. And that's just not as interesting. I like it when the character is an individual and does not have the burden of representing all people who kind of look like them.
Yeah.
And you could certainly write a story that way that is actually diverse. But I think we're still at a transition point where a lot of stories don't quite meet that standard. So
one, it's there. Would you say that there's an element of that to actually delve into these unique people within these various diverse communities is not actually profitable at this point, in the sense that people are so stuck in their mindset of what, you know, certain communities, you know, hold to belief wise or do, or their like perceived ideals of those communities. They're just not interested in reading actually real drawn out characters.
I think there can be resistance to,
yeah.
I think if you draw people in and tell a good story, then it can be profitable.
Yeah.
I think where it's still a marketing issue,
mm-hmm.
where you try to pitch a story and the Mirage, when it started out as a TV series pitch, and it was just like, yeah, they were like, yeah, that's no.
Yeah.
And the same thing with, you know, Lovecraft Country, my last novel. I originally pitched that as a TV show, and it was like, it's going to be a story with an almost entirely black ensemble cast set in the 1950s. And it's, you know, it's supernatural horror, but also the horrors of racism. And that was a hard sell back in 2007, because they're like, well, you mean everybody's going to be black? And like, you know, like, yeah, I don't want to give the protagonist a white friend, because this is going to be about the horrors of racism. And so I wanted to stay focused on people
black,
for
yeah.
whom it is a horror. And mm-hmm. if you, I don't want the white friend who's there for the audience to feel okay. I would be that guy. It's like, no, that's not what the story is about. The story is about what it's like to be somebody who can't even, you know, take a cross-country drive without worrying they're going to get pulled over and shot because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think once you get to a point where you can pitch those stories and have them accepted, then it becomes much easier to draw audiences in. But we're still at a point where, again, I think a knee-jerk reaction from some people is going to be, you know, they're just doing this to, you know, be social justice or whatever.
Yeah.
This is just virtue signaling. And the thing is, occasionally it's kind of true. Like, there are stories that are really like that where it really is playing more to a trend and are not very good. But that happens often enough that I am somewhat sympathetic sometimes that people are hesitant, but you've got to try and present the story in a way that talk about the part of the story that's interesting that will appeal to people, even if they could care less about diversity.
Yeah.
And the people who want diversity will notice, oh, this is a black ensemble cast. And the people who just want to get, you know, a good horror story, you can get them too.
Yes.
And after a while, you know, hopefully they'll notice, oh yeah, so this actually isn't just social justice nonsense. This is actually kind of cool. And you're able to do things with these characters that you might not if you were doing a more traditional whites only casting.
Yeah, very true. No, that's great. I was thinking, while you're talking about that, I was thinking about the James Baldwin essay, and I can't remember which one it is, where he talks about Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and his critique of it was this idea that he kind of lost the plot towards the end because he could tell that he had an agenda in mind, and by the end of it, Baldwin was like, yeah, it no longer became a story. It became propaganda ultimately, and that was his critique of it. But it's fascinating to see that, like, I still believe in the power of literature to change hearts and minds. But getting to that point where people are actually reading it, that's fascinating.
I mean, I think, you know, I mean, propaganda. I mean, there is really good propaganda.
Like, yes.
Although I satirize it, I have to say I'm quite impressed to this day with what Ayn Rand did in Atlas Shrugged. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't agree with her philosophy at all,
yeah.
But I totally understand why that book is, like, you know, gone through 60 printings and is still around so much later. I mean, she did an amazing job with that. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's definitely a propaganda story entirely. And the characters are, they're not people, they're idealized notions.
Yeah.
And that's there's certainly room in my idea of art for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that is not going to appeal to as many people as just a well-told tale. And I find in my own writing that I certainly like to play with ideas, but I tend to write more interesting stories where I focus on the story elements and let the, you know, I let you decide what you want to think. Mm-hmm. I will, you know, I'll talk about this stuff, but I like to have those kinds of conclusions arise organically in the course of telling a good story.
Yeah.
Partly because I think it just makes my writing better, but also in terms of engaging a wider variety of readers. There's just some people who don't want to be preached to, and if they think you're going to, they're just going to shut you out right away. And,
yeah.
But you know, yeah, it's true though that there is a lot of literature can and other forms of storytelling really can have an effect on society, and I don't begrudge anyone who wants to really push that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a tendency often, especially right now, we're going through a cycle when people are leaning very heavily on the idea that yes, we've got to see literature strictly through that lens of what effect is this going to have on society?
Yeah.
Is, you know, is this too dangerous a story to be talking mm-hmm. about right now? And I always kind of roll my eyes at that because I'm like, you know, sometimes the best time to tell a dangerous story is exactly when people don't think they want to hear it. That's why I came up with the idea of the Mirage in the middle of the Iraq War, because it's like, what better time to talk about the war on terror while it's still going on? And, but yeah, of course that's my commercially my least successful novel. So I may have been wrong.
Well, you never know. Like that, I feel like that's one of those things where, you'll find out years from now, because it might be one of those that people come back to and rediscover later on.
So. I mean, I'm absolutely not sorry I wrote it. I think it's one of the best books, but it's just like, yeah, as in terms of, you know, gauging, if I were hoping to, you know, penetrate the market on that one, well, no, that didn't work out. But
yeah, no doubt. So, so what were the basic elements of virtual reality and really technology in general that you were driven to explore within your book?
I think that the main thing was just this. I was fascinated by this idea of, particularly in the initial conception of telling a story, like when I was initially envisioning this as a TV show, right, where a story where you would never see people as they really were, but mm-hmm. only as they chose to present themselves. And, you know, and the novel, of course, I do have the unmasking at the end, so you finally do find out who's who and what's what. But I was just fascinated by this idea of, the way in which, it's not even virtual reality so much as any online mediation at all, because people were doing this even on the days of Usenet, and certainly happens on Twitter, of people passing themselves off as something they're not, or just being encouraged by the ability to say things pseudonymously or anonymously, to do things that they might not, or to treat online behaviors as somehow counting less or differently than behaviors in real life. Like a lot of the in-game harassment you see in these online role-playing games. Well, part of the reason for that is it's not the same thing to ruin somebody's playtime than it is to, like, if you were to actually run up to someone in the street and assail them. And partly because if you run up to the street to assail them, a lot of the times you're going to get your lights punched out.
But,
but it's also just, it's all virtual, so it doesn't count. And then too, there's the connectivity, the fact that it online, if you let it, allows you to connect with people with very different ways of thinking than you. So it's like a culture shock on tap 24/7 in a way that was really not possible before the internet happened
or something.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
So I think that was the main thing that drew me to it and played to my interest, because again, I just love culture wars and culture clashes. And I like that idea of, let me put myself in the head of someone who isn't me and see where that goes. That is the main thing that I was pulling for, I think.
And you almost, if you think about that, it's almost kind of meta, because you're writing a book about virtual reality where people can become something or someone that they aren't. And yet you're being the author writing these characters as someone that you're not.
Right. So, right. Exactly. I mean, and I'm well aware of that as I'm doing it. So,
yeah, no doubt. I bet. So when I read your book, initially, I found myself going back again and again to some of the imagery presented in Pixar, WALL-E. And I'm assuming you've seen that.
Oh yeah.
Yes. So there's these scenes where these people are basically living in chairs on the ship, and they no longer have to move. They just live their life from a place of comfort. But there's this toll that it takes ultimately, and it becomes deeply unhealthy, and their muscles atrophy. And there comes a point where they actually have to get up out of their chairs, and they have a hard, like, they can't move because they've been so comfortable. And it's hilarious, but it's really disturbing if you're taking in the meaning of the movie at that point.
Yeah.
So I wondered, when, as I lived in this world that you created, I wondered to myself, if this were to happen, how would this change the taxonomy of humanity? Characters like Anya, who are completely paralyzed in reality, are given freedom and a social life. But what do you think the other side of it is? What are the major effects of this world you've created on the race of beings, ultimately?
I'm tempted to say that the real villain here is not virtual reality. It's the creation of the desk.
Yeah. I could see that.
As soon as human beings, moved indoors and found ways to spend entire days sitting at a desk, I think we started to change and became more sedentary, at least those of us who were lucky enough to be able to do that.
Yes.
And certainly, the invention of computers and video games gave maybe more people, and before that, television gave more people an excuse to, sit slack-jawed and not moving for hours at a time. Although, come to think of it, we did that with books too. It's like basically as soon as you've got intellectual pursuits and the intellectual life, you've got this problem of people spending entire days in their head.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about virtual reality in my experience is that I'm actually much more active using VR than I am even playing a regular video game. If I'm playing a video game on a regular screen, I'm just moving my mouse hand and that's it. Or maybe I'm typing on the keyboard. With VR, it's funny. I had foot surgery last year, and so there was a period of several weeks where I was in that annoying boot, and I was allowed to put weight on it, but still, it very much limited my walking. I generally try to walk, at least 5 miles a day, and I couldn't do that. So to sort of But what I was doing to at least give myself some exercise, I was playing this VR boxing game that was giving me cardio. And part of the appeal of you know, the fully immersive VR, I think, is that you're not just passively looking. You are actually walking around or moving, and, you know, or at least that will be the case once I'm able to do that without, you know, in a large enough space where I don't have to worry about slamming into the wall. My current office is long but narrow, so I don't have a lot of maneuvering room. But once yeah. once I untether my VR headset and can, you know, go to a larger space, I mean, I actually see being much more physically active in that technology than not.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
So, you know, I think to the extent that our taxonomy has changed, that's already happened. And this is maybe going to be a shift in a different direction, although I'm sure we will still find other excuses to sit still and not yeah, do stuff.
Exactly. There's no doubt about that. We're quite good at that as a species. So this concept of virtual reality allows anyone to be any race, creed, gender, or even species is a fascinating one that has a significant role throughout your book's narrative. Did you go into the writing of this book cynical that there might come a time when truth becomes nearly impossible to decipher within relationships mediated through technology? Or did you come into it thinking that these elements of VR might allow us to maybe express ourselves more honestly, whether good or bad, because there is this built-in pseudonymity?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. And I think that I like to believe you can always figure out the truth to the extent that there is one, given enough time and effort. At the same time, I think that, you know, one of the concepts I talk about in the book too is this whole idea of how of sort of context failure, mm-hmm. where you're shifting from one environment where the social rules and stuff are one way, and you move to a different context where different social rules apply. And if you're flipping back and forth fast enough, which can happen online, you sometimes forget where you are and do things that would be no big deal in one context, but are like horrible sins or faux pas in others. And yeah. This is the thing that, as many people on Twitter have discovered, is like, you know, statements that might be non-controversial among your close friends are quite different when the entire universe is able to review them. And like, why yeah. are you using that word? And you can't say that. And, you know, we're going to find out where you live now and get rid of your job. And mm-hmm. I think part of it is who we are may vary somewhat based on where we are and who we're with. And you know, there's definitely a common core of identity, but I think one of the things is just because in the modern world we're shifting context constantly, our actual core identities are probably somewhat fluid, and that I'm one person with in this place and a different person in another place. And yeah, and then when you add on that element of pseudonymity, it's like, okay, I whatever I do here, even if I screw up, I'm not going to be held permanently accountable for it. That will change the way some people behave. And yeah. it can enable both more honest behavior. It can, you know, enable people to admit things about themselves that they've been repressing, that mm-hmm. they're perhaps healthier enough admitting, like, oh, I'm gay, or, oh, I'm, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But it can also, you know, allow people to fool themselves into thinking that, you know, behavior that harms people isn't as bad or doesn't count because you don't see the consequences of your action.
Yeah.
But that's that again has always been something that's been the case when you know, as long as people have been able to separate themselves from the consequences of their actions, mm-hmm. It's just that it's become a more democratic thing now where more people can behave that way. But like, people in power have always been able to do things knowing that it's not going to come back on them and behave in horrible ways in some context. And then, you know, you're the sweetest person of all with your family and perfectly kind. And then you go off to work and you're a CIA torturer, and that's not going to follow you home, so you don't think about it, you mm-hmm. know? And it's just now with the internet, anybody can put on a mask and reach out thousands of miles and mess with people. But you can also, you know, reach out 1,000 miles and connect with someone you would never meet otherwise and get to know them and learn something about them. So it's not all horrible. It's just, it's something that you can do good things with or bad things with. And that's just kind of really interesting.
Yeah. It's a matter of, it's one of those things where really it's with any technology or any kind of context, mm-hmm. you can do that. There's ways you can act and use it, you know, in a way that's going to be beneficial for you and others. And then there's other ways where it will be not beneficial to others and possibly you. That's just part of technology that I'm hesitant to say it's writ neutral, but it's not necessarily good or bad. So
I know what you mean. It's too easy to say it's totally neutral, but yeah. I think that it's there's a range of potentials, and a lot of it is just what you choose to do. Mm-hmm. And all you can do is just sort of try to pay attention and think things through and you know, try to be honest with yourself and listen to other people. So, and I think that just be aware of, you know, different pathologies that are enabled by online and ways to work around them. I try to be more open to people and try to interpret things they say in good faith. And I occasionally get annoyed at me because I tend to interpret things in the best possible way. And sometimes, no, somebody really is an asshole and I'm just slow to come to the conclusion because I want to believe the best of them. But it's useful for my job, even if I realize that somebody is really a vile person. There's value to me in understanding why they do what they do and how they come to that conclusion. And so the internet allows you to sort of follow people and gain insight into people who you don't even necessarily like, but you can at least figure them out. And I love to figure people out. Mm-hmm. So
I remember reading an article a while back talking about the kind of the delivery of Blu-ray versus HD and why Blu-ray ended up winning that competition on format of film, like physical copy film, and a lot of it dealt with the porn industry. And they picked up on Blu-ray largely from the beginning, and because of the profitability of it, like, Blu-ray kind of found itself being the front runner and HD kind of dropped away because of porn. I find it fascinating that in your book you talk about this element of sex and cyber sex, and there's an idea that one of your characters has about a RPG game where you can have sex in the midst of it if you desire to. But John Chu he's saying, well, how would you market that? And so there's a lot of ideas going on in here that are fascinating to me. I know you said that you're kind of wanting to deal with how John Chu as a Chinese American gets to play a role that often Asian man doesn't get to play in pop culture. What other elements of this drive towards how sex and technology intersect were you kind of wanting to explore?
One of the other things that, you know, plays into a lot of my novels, I'm sort of firmly of the belief that some of the best drama is hiding in the part of the forest where you don't want to go.
Yeah.
And I often know I'm onto something when I start worrying that, geez, if I, you know, I'm a little nervous about writing about this, and if I do it badly, it will be horribly embarrassing, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'll have to change my name. And like, some of the best story ideas are ones that make me a little nervous. Mm-hmm. And I've become confident enough in my ability as a writer that you know, if I push past that initial apprehension, that's often the most interesting part of the story. And particularly in American culture, I think just talking about the whole idea of cyber sex is typically treated as either a joke or a pathology. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if I could write about it in a way where it's just another part of the online experience without, you know, either scoffing about it or grossing people out by being a little too graphic. I just wanted to talk about like some of the goofier aspects of trying to implement it and the difficulties people would have at coming to terms with it, but also just talk about the fact this is going to happen and, you know, what's something interesting I can say about that and how can I affect the story? And I did want to also, I wanted to find a way to tell this story, which is set, you know, almost entirely online, but still have this guy have a physical relationship of sorts with this woman who he's never met. It just seemed like an interesting thing to try to pull off. And, you know, again, as soon as I thought of it, I'm like, yeah, you do that wrong, it's going to be terrible. Mm-hmm. But I thought, you know, but if I do it right, it'll probably be really interesting and it'll just add one more cool thing to the story. So I think that was the main thing that drew me in about that. And again, there's just, you know, some fun bits of business that I found to wove into it.
For sure.
But this is also just, this is something that is going to happen. And, you know, for everybody online who's just sort of like making bad jokes about sex robots and, oh my God, who would want to do that? I'm like, I don't know. I have a feeling that this is going to be more popular than people realize. And more than that, there's a lot of money to be made there. So again, mm-hmm. this is a story about an entrepreneur. It would certainly be something he'd think about, and he would think not just about the money to be made, but, you know, the downside of it's very difficult to get financing for anything sexually explicit online. Any game that gets an adults only rating, it's going to be much harder to finance, to market, to advertise. If cybersex, you know, if and when cybersex actually happens, I'm sure the government is going to be very interested, and any politician looking to score cheap points is going to say, oh, but what about the children? And so it's just, there's just a lot of interesting territory there to play around with. And I wanted to touch on that in the course of the story. So that was sort of what got me into that, I think. And again, just, can I make this work without grossing people out or embarrassing mm-hmm. myself horribly? So,
and making some really, really tangible points about the nature of sex and, you know, sex in pop culture and sex in American society as a whole, because sex has always been one of those things that has kind of grated against the remnants of the Puritan American yeah. ethic. And so it's, like to basically write about sex, you're going to go against the grain a little bit in this country. And so, but I found some of those parts to be some of the most intriguing elements of the story. And I think you really nailed some really like tangible ideas on how sex and technology especially could work its way out into everyday life. So.
Well, cool. I'm glad it worked.
Yeah, no, it did.
That seems to have been the general response so far. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah,
I'll be very curious to see if this ever gets filmed, how they handle that.
Oh, but, no doubt. Yeah.
So
they have to find a more transgressive director, possibly.
Well, part of it is you have to find a clever way to communicate, because this is one of those things where a lot of the more interesting bits is just John Chu talking about the history of this, and it's a real challenge to translate some of that stuff to a visual medium in a way that, yes, does not get you a hard R rating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to see the whole chapter with the text-based game being put to to the screen.
That's going to be another one. That will be, yeah. Yeah.
Which, by the way, is probably my, it's in the running for my favorite chapter. So.
Excellent. We spent a lot of time on the orthography of that, I found out most of the people working at HarperCollins had no idea what a text-based adventure game was or what it looked like. So we spent a lot of time just figuring out what font and how to format it. And so I'm quite happy with how it turned out. But that was a weirdly difficult thing to pull off. So
wow. Interesting. Yeah. Well, it worked. It worked. So my final question for you is do you have any topics that you would want to tackle in the future? Like any dream topics that you've always kind of wanted to, you know, mess around with, but you just haven't found the right, you know, conduit or something like that?
I have a lot of, again, I have a lot of larval ideas for stories mm-hmm. in my head, things that I think I could do something with, but they're missing an element. like one of the ideas I got interested in roller derby.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, here in Seattle. And I came up with this idea for a story about a roller girl team who basically caught up in a contest to be the first to land on another planet. You know, that there's this idea of X Prize is like, you know, rich guys like Elon Musk and, you know, offering like bounties for achieving certain things, like, you know, be the first person to get a rocket into orbit, you know, at such and such a time and so forth. And we'll give you this much money and, you know, be the first person to land a private rocket on the moon and bring the person back alive and you'll get X amount of money. And so, yeah, I came up with this idea for, yeah, somehow getting this roller girl team to, you know, bid to be the crew for as part of this race to be the first to land on another planet and come back safely. And I have the beginning. I know how I want it to end. It's just like there's bits and pieces of what actually will happen when they get there that I haven't figured out yet. So there's this whole kind of big chunk of the novel that doesn't exist yet. And yeah. So what will happen is I will, you know, one day I'll be walking along and I will have an epiphany and it will come to me and I'll be like, oh yeah. And then I'll be able to write the book really quickly. And that's generally how it works. So yeah, I could spin you a bunch of other ideas, but basically there's nothing quite ready to go yet. I'm still toying with the idea of I would love to do a Lovecraft Country sequel or a series of them, and I think that's what I'm gonna, you know, try pitching next. It's just a question of really gonna be a question of whether HarperCollins will wanna be on board with that, because if I go back to that fictional world, it won't just be one book. It'll be at least two more and possibly three. And that's kind of a big commitment for a publisher to make, but the fact that there's going to be an HBO series may help me with that. But I think that's going to be my next attempt at something. And I may end up writing that even if I can't get a taker for it, because I really enjoyed that cast of characters. And I feel like I've got more stuff to say, which is the other thing is I'm generally not a sequel guy, but because it's not enough to just, you know, more of the same, but I think I've got some new and different things I'd like to do with those characters and with that setup and that will be different from, but complementary to the way the series will shape up. So we'll see. But that's sort of my current dream project, but God knows what I'm actually going to do next.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. We will be back on Friday with a new episode. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles. We would like to thank Threaded Zebra Agency, AltSpace VR, Derooted, and Creative Mornings for their support and work on this podcast. We will see you soon.